This is Canned Heat.
Woo! With one beer, two beers, three beers, a shot of whiskey.
You're listening to Canned Heat on the Aaron Mehta Show.
Yes, yes, y'all. How's it going? Thanks for tuning in once again. You are through to the Canned Heat podcast with myself, Nick, and always co-hosting with me is Scott. Today, it's going to be the start of a new series of podcasts. We had fun doing our SmackDown retrospective 2 weeks ago, so we're going to dive deep into a bit of nostalgia, and we're going to bookend pay-per-views, starting with Bash at the Beach Hostile Takeover from 1996. Famously, when Hulk Hogan came out as the Mystery Man, and in essence, the genesis of the NWO. We're going to do a deep dive on that, and we're going to discuss it at depth, mine some of those old memories from when we watched wrestling when we were younger. So this is the start of this series. Hope you enjoy.
Yeah, so let's get right into it. Bash at the Beach 96, Hostile Takeover. Daytona Beach, Florida. Attendance of 8,600.
8,300 I've got here, but that'll do. And
Yeah, around the 8,000 to 9,000 mark.
Yeah, So 7th impressive. Of July, so middle of summer.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Fairly impressive audience. And for...
Fairly impressive audience.
Fairly impressive audience for the time.
For the time.
And history-wise, this is probably one of the most recognised and important pay-per-views in terms of wrestling.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah, very much. Yeah. So, obviously, it was at Daytona Beach, Florida. And do you love the cheesy set that they had? You know, like, they have all the surfboards and shit and, like, sand, like, that they kind of put near the entranceway.
Yeah, so many props. So many props, which matches got into really using a lot later on. But
yes,
it's like,
yes.
If you watch it, it's like super 90s graphics at the beginning. Super 90s sort of little... promos in between and stuff like that, and it's got a real mid-90s nostalgia feel about the whole thing. And real classic WCW here. If you're a fan of it, you can watch it on the WWE Network, not sponsored, okay, but you can watch it there and give that a watch maybe after the podcast and just see what memories come up for you in your wrestling past.
It is proper 90s television, isn't it?
Yeah,
really starts off obviously with a good old Tony Schiavone using one of his classic lines, one of the greatest nights in the history of this great sport. He used to say that a lot.
Yeah.
So Tony Schiavone.
Yeah, so we had on commentary, you've got a triple threat of Bobby the Brain Heenan, Tony Schiavone, and Dusty Rhodes.
I don't think he was actually on the main commentary, the Dream, was he? Did he come in and out? Because I know Mike Tenay was involved as well, wasn't he, obviously?
Yeah, he came in and out here and there.
He wasn't a great commentator, really, Dusty, was he? He was a great character. It's Dusty Rhodes, for Christ's sake. But
yeah.
Not the best commentator in the world.
No, not the best commentator in the world. Did come in and out with some great lines and using words like noggin instead of head, which I always found really funny.
He had a beautiful way of speaking, didn't he, Dusty?
Yeah. And so the first match was Psicosis versus Rey Mysterio Jr. Standard luchador match for the time.
Brilliant
match. WCW became known for it, bringing those old Mexican wrestlers in.
Yeah.
And they really put on some fucking amazing shows.
They bumped their asses off in this. Like, obviously, yeah. they had a feud. Apparently, it said that they wrestled in Mexico the night before.
Really?
It's mentioned on commentary, I think it was by Mike Tenay. But there was like, yeah, like, them two, they said, like, yeah, they wrestled in Mexico the night before, and they got to the arena, like, hours before the match.
Wow.
Apparently.
So they're going in there like jet lagged and
battered, probably beaten up, beaten up, and like they bumped their asses off in this match, didn't they?
Yeah, it was really it was a really really good match. As I say, standard for the time, that level, that sort of that expectancy from a WCW audience is really high for those matches.
But that was still relatively new for American audiences at the time, though, wasn't it? That kind of match was still relatively new for American audiences.
Yeah, I mean, standard to the time is sort of a retrospective look at it.
Yeah.
They became known for those sort of high-flying matches with some incredibly brilliant spots in them. Rey Mysterio Jr., he still had the Jr. moniker on his name at that time, got the win. And,
like, there were some big bumps like that from the sent onto the outside, and they were quite stiff for luchadors. I thought, like, luchadors have a reputation of kind of going light and just being flippy and floppy and flyy.
Yeah.
But like, they were laying that shit in.
Oh yeah, they were really, really sticking it to them, which is, again, I think a nice dynamic to a luchador match. So it's not all, as you say, like high flying, flippy, floppy, flappy, flying around. It was, but the
some hard shots.
Yeah, some really, really hard. Like, at one point, stiff there was a, shots in there.
Sorry to cut you off. So at one point, there was a Psychosis was hurricane rounded by Ray. And he landed right on the top of his head about halfway into the match. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
But it just didn't faze him at all. It was just...
No, just straight back up. Which is insane to think at the time, the amount of bumps that could happen and stuff.
There would be match ending today.
Yeah, you'd just get up and get on with it.
Just crack on.
Yeah, it's crazy. So, yeah, that was a good solid opener, I think, to the pay-per-view. Really good solo.
The finish was top. Like you said, Ray got the win, and it was a what do they call it now? Splash Mountain. It was like a Razor's Edge. So he was doing it off the top. Obviously, Psychosis had Ray up.
Yeah.
In the Splash Mountain or the Razor's Edge is basically what it was, like a top rope Razor's Edge, which he reversed midair into a Hurricane Rana.
Yeah.
Which I really liked. Like.
Yeah, that's a sick move, isn't it? It's a good solid ending to a solid opening
dangerous
match.
A good dangerous move always pops me.
You can't go wrong with a good dangerous move. Yeah. If something looks fancy and it looks dangerous, yeah, I'm
so long
down
as they're
that.
Aching at the end of it, I'm happy.
Yeah. Next up, we had a sock on a pole match, as I've got it written down.
that was ridiculous, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. A lot of stipulations in this pay-per-view.
Very, very WCW, very old Southern wrestling.
Yeah, like crazy stipulations. We start with this sock on a pole match.
There was silver dollars, apparently, yeah, silver in a dollars. Sock.
In a sock, and not much else to take away from that match.
Oh, there was. I think there was. Like, so really? You've not said who was in it yet, Dick.
Apart from the gimmicks? Oh, sorry.
Who was wrestling, Scott?
Go on.
John Tenta, so yep. Earthquake, to your WF fans. And Big Bubba, who was? Come on, Scott. You don't know who that was? You didn't recognise him?
No.
Seriously?
No.
It's Boss Man.
Oh, shit, of course, yeah.
Damn it.
Big Boss Man. Big
but yeah, well, like, obviously, Big Boss Man was a WWF trademark name.
Yeah.
So he came in as, I believe he was originally Big Bubba Rogers, but they just called him Big Bubba. And yeah. That was, like, two big men and, like, you know, hitting each other hard like big men do. And the weirdest thing I thought in that match was John Tenta Earthquake. Did you see what was going on with his hair? What was going on with his barnet?
Yeah, there's a
he
lot.
He had like
of...
a half because he has like a skullet anyway, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, there was a lot of questionable barnets on the show. There's some very very 90s wrestling barnets going on.
Even further back than that, they're like because it's in the south and they're a bit behind.
Yeah,
I think. But he had like a half shaved skullet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was weird, man. That was weird. That hair was just. Ridiculous and hilarious, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But did you have anything else to say about that?
No, I thought it was, I liked, there was a nice visual at the end where they put two of the silver dollars on the guy's eyes as he's on the floor.
Yeah, I like that.
Classic death things, I like that. Other than that, it was one of those gimmick matches, kind of fun to watch, entertaining.
I was a little bit confused by the stip, though. The stipulation, I was a little bit confused, like, was it no DQ or not? Because at one point...
So it's an on-a-pole match.
Yeah, so that means that technically means that it's no DQ.
Yeah, so on-a-pole match, for those of you who don't know, is basically there's a pole in one corner of the ring with something hanging from it. Yeah. It's usually something quite comical.
As it was in this one.
And the aim of the match is to get up. And yeah, in this match it was like a sock. That's why I've got it as a sock on a pole match. and the aim is to get up to the pole and pull down whatever. In this case, the sock full of silver dollars that he then battered with everyone. WCW really ran with these on a pole matches for a while.
Yes.
And the most ridiculous they got, I believe, was a...
Judy Bagwell on a pole match?
Yeah, Buff Bagwell's mum on a pole match. The mum on a pole match. Where Buff Bagwell's mum was stood on a platform at the top of a pole in the corner of a wrestling
It was
ring.
An interesting choice of match to go for. Maybe it had something to do with the ending, but obviously these are two big, big fellas who are over 6'5 each, over in the high 300 pounds each.
Yeah.
They're not going to... Like, you can't just reach the top of this pole. It's too tall. So you had to shimmy up the pole, but because they were that big, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, so
could they?
It makes for funny visuals.
Yeah.
Which but I don't know if that was the intention, but it certainly is what the result
Jimmy
was.
Hart, obviously, who was Bubba's manager, ended up shimmying up the pole, didn't he?
Yeah.
To get it down. But lo and behold, John Tenta got it off him and then twatted him in the head with the sock.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting match. Visual.
So after that, you've got a Lex Luger, Sting, and Macho Man promo. And the running storyline that they're going with through this show is obviously that the Outsiders have a third man that they're bringing in who's going to be their third man in the six-man tag match.
Very important.
And they're really pushing, like, who could this third man be? And they're kind of teasing that it's Eric Bischoff, even though that the Outsiders, they show, attacked Eric Bischoff a few weeks ago. They're saying that he's not being seen. Where is he?
Yeah.
And it's sort of laying out a red herring for you to think, like, could it be Eric Bischoff? Is Eric Bischoff going to come in? It's real, real sort of...
Good narrative device.
A little red herring there for fans to sort of try and grab hold of. And an interesting little sub-storyline going through the entire show is, where's Eric Bischoff?
It's a more of a technical thing, but something I noticed about that really bugged me. Why wasn't Macho Man facing the camera?
He always did that, didn't he? He would always turn his back to the camera and
talk. But what, yeah, but why, though?
I don't know.
Because he was coked up, probably.
Because he's a Randy Savage.
Because he was thinking about raping.
Jesus Christ.
You said he was a Randy Savage.
Bloody hell. Okay, so next we have another stipulation match, another gimmick match, if you will.
This one.
Which really confused me. So this is a taped fist match.
What's one of those?
DDP against Jim Duggan. Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Oh! Had to, sorry.
So the taped fist stipulation is that they've got wrestling tape, so just tape, like...
Athletic tape
around their fists. And it's supposed to increase damage.
Is it, though?
It's supposed to, but that's kind of a hard sell.
But it doesn't.
Because it doesn't, and lots of wrestlers wear tape on their fists anyway.
You wear tape on your fists to protect your knuckles. That's why boxers tape their fists before they go into a glove.
Yeah.
It's because it protects your hands from compound fractures.
Yeah, so it's an interesting... A really interesting stipulation. They did kind of make good use of it at the beginning by, like, DDP, who was working heel, which was interesting to see.
Yeah.
Pull his tape off his hand and tie together Jim Duggan's feet around the ring post.
Yeah.
And
I was always rooting for Duggan, because when I watched wrestling when I was very little, I loved him because he looks like me dad. And me dad, at the time, was a carpenter as well.
Oh, so your dad...
He obviously carries a 2x4 to the ring. My dad's got, like, long hair and a bit... He's a lot shorter than Hacksaw and doesn't have any muscle, really, but he had a belly and long hair and he worked with wood.
So your dad's like a Hacksaw Jim Duggan from Manchester.
Yeah, if you like, but a lot smaller.
Yeah. Well, I found... So another spectacular Barnett in this match is DDP's perm mullet. He's got a perm and it's a mullet and it's fantastic. He's working heel and he's just so over the top. It's like comical. Right. Like the bumps he takes are crazy. Like he does this spot, which if you're a wrestling fan, you'll know all too well, where they grab your head and they pummel it into the turnbuckle.
I always like that.
I always liked it, but like DDP's just going nuts, slamming his head into this turnbuckle. Like Jim Duggan's
slamming. But how he does it these days, doesn't he?
Yeah, Jim Duggan's slamming DDP's head into the turnbuckle, and TDP's really going for the oversell on it, and like sort of flopping and flailing around, and that made it the whole match kind of comical, you know, with Hacksaw Jim Duggan and his host all the time.
Yeah,
and yeah, DDP sort of working this comic, well, he's finding
his feet really, DDP, because this must be early in his career, really, maybe a year in, if that.
Yeah, also
obviously he's been around the business forever, but like these. His first start as a wrestler or a worker, isn't it?
Yeah. What I found quite funny, because I was thinking that's like he just started wrestling, so now obviously we have the retrospect of looking at his entire career, but at this point he's just finding things. And one thing I noted is he kept putting his hands up above his head with his fingers spread wide, but his arms were apart. And I wonder, because if you know DDP, his whole thing was putting his hands above his head with his fingers spread apart to make a diamond.
Diamond sign, yeah.
And he wasn't doing the diamond sign here. So I wonder, at what point did he think, hang on, if I move my hands together, it looks like a diamond. My name's Diamond Dallas Page.
Yeah.
And there we go. There's my little...
That's your theory. That's where the genesis of that was.
That one day he was, you know, standing in his bathroom looking in the mirror sort of thing, and how
stretching.
Good do I look?
Stretching
out, looking, like, how good does this pose look? And then he goes, wait a minute, hang on. My fingers kind of look like a diamond if I put them together. And there you go.
Well, there you go.
I think that's my theory anyway.
I'll go with that, mate. I'd say that sounds fair enough. We'll let us know, DDP, if you listen.
Yeah, so DDP gets the win with a diamond cutter.
Not the best looking diamond cutter, I didn't think.
No, he's not honed it in yet at this point. He's not honed in the
because I love diamond. I love a diamond cutter or an RKO.
Yeah. So after that match, obviously we said DDP gets the win. We had a promo with Jimmy Hart, Kevin Sullivan, and the Giant. Yeah. Talking to Mean Gene. And sort of their storyline in this is they're opposing the Four Horsemen. And there's that sort of thing. My biggest note that I took from that is Giant, who is obviously more famously known as Big Show. Mm-hmm. This is very early in his career as well.
He was the champ at the time as well, and yeah. He dethroned Hogan not so long prior to that.
Yeah, so he's the champ. And my note that I've got from this is his voice is so raspy, it is ridiculous. Clear your damn throat. He's got that, you know, the over the top. What is it with wrestlers always have really raspy voices?
They chew tobacco, probably. I don't know. Is that it? They are in the South.
Hulk Hogan's famous for his raspy sort of almost growl voice, and Big Show or Giant here is so raspy. It's like just drink some water or clear your throat or something, because it's just obnoxiously gravelly. Yeah.
But it makes you sound more. That's the thing. It makes you sound more macho, I suppose.
More macho, more menacing.
Yeah, obviously the Macho Man, the best voice in wrestling. Obviously, that's his shoot voice. That was how he would order a coffee, with that voice. So
yeah,
that's why he's one of the best, because he has a cool voice.
Interesting side note.
Go on. Is it? I'll be the judge.
No, this is an interesting side
note. I'll be the judge of whether it's interesting or not.
Wrestlers have raspy voices.
All right.
Generally speaking.
Generally.
Not many soft-spoken wrestlers.
Like Bailey.
Yeah, I'm sure once she's had 20 cigs and a bottle of whiskey, her voice gets pretty raspy. See how much of a hugger she is then.
Oh, and the rest.
Yeah.
She gets a bit leery. Bailey.
After that, we have the sort of the promo with Benoit and Arn Anderson. They're sort of giving lots of exposition to the whole narrative that they're involved in with the Four Horsemen and the Giant and Kevin Sullivan. Benoit's got this very rigid three words that he accentuates at a time promo, and it's
what does he say?
Randy Wrestling. I can't remember word for word, but he's saying stuff like, "And on this Sunday, when we fought you,
you sound
the
like
last time you sound when they fought us, and everybody was fighting." And it's like, that's just...
You sound like the kid from Malcolm in the Middle who was in the wheelchair.
Yeah, well, that's...
The one, the asthmatic kid.
A little less breathy, but that's what Benoit was sounding like here. And then after that promo, we have another stipulation match.
Of course.
So that's three stipulation matches in a row. This is a four-man dog collar match between Public Enemy and the Nasty Boys.
Yeah. They were over Public Enemy, weren't they? They really were.
Yeah, really, really over.
The whitest men in the world with the blackest gimmick.
They're sort of like street gimmicky type of thing.
But like they were so clearly like white and not from the streets though.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be non-white to be from the streets, but they were definitely sort of pushing that
hip hop
90s
sort of
style. Yeah, which for the 90s, being obviously we don't want to get too political into this. And I'm sure there's lots of sort of sub-meanings that are going straight over our heads at the minute. But there's for the 90s, this is definitely something where you're hip-hop and you dress like that and you're white, you kind of stand out a bit. So, yeah, quite funny.
What are you getting at there? I'm not sure I follow your point there, mate.
So just because they're white, just because the colour of someone's skin doesn't determine what sort of clothes that they have to wear.
No, it doesn't.
In this day and age, especially, you know, people can wear what they want and do what they want. So a sign and saying this is what white people wear, this is what black people wear, is a bit, you know.
All right, okay, I kind of see what you're getting at.
Whereas in the 90s, it was a lot more commonplace.
Interesting point.
So that's maybe why it stands out a little.
But it was kind of interesting because it was kind of almost like two subcultures against each other. So you had the hip hop subculture against the Nasty Boys, who are kind of like street punks, aren't they?
Yeah.
The thing about the Nasty Boys that I always thought of, because it's exactly at the same time as this game, but did you ever play Streets of Rage as a child?
Not as a child, I played as an adult though.
You didn't have a Mega Drive as a kid?
No.
Alright, okay. Well, I had a Mega Drive, I played a lot of Streets of Rage. Do they not look like henchmen from Streets of Rage?
Yeah, they kind of do look like henchmen from Streets of Rage.
They do, like bleach blonde, you know, shaved mullets and like those jackets that they've got all spray paint all over them and whatnot.
Yeah.
And like the shirts, they've got the kind of paint motif on them. They look just like street punks from Streets of Rage.
It is. It's like, it's almost like what the media said evil people look like from the streets in the 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they look like extras from RoboCop.
Yeah, I bet those guys graffiti everywhere. They're rapscallions.
Yeah, they look like extras from RoboCop too.
Yeah. So this was essentially like a props match. This is the biggest match that got into all the set and sort of the surf. There was a two count on the surfboard at one point, which was quite funny. They're using like all the lifeguard and equipment and stuff that's there as obviously part of this set. Mm-hmm. You know, they're fighting in the beach area that's to the side of the entrance ramp. And it was a good match, though.
The Nasty Boys are just like sloppy fighters, though, aren't they?
Yeah, it was definitely scrappy. It wasn't like a text wrestling masterclass, was it?
Oh, hell no. But like the Nasty Boys never did. They just twat you and like throw out hard moves, suplex people on hard things. Like a lot of choking, a lot of hitting with the chain and whatnot and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Did anyone get collar?
No, I don't. No, no one bled. Hmm. But yeah, very interesting. There was a definite. If you're a fan of Botchamania, there's a recurring spot called "I Am the Table" where it's table spots that don't break.
Sorry,
there's
a really, really weird noise. And that was I was gonna say that.
Oh, sorry. Well, it's something we both noticed. There's two table spots where the table doesn't break, and it's
Fly by Rocco Rock, isn't it? I think.
And how the hell he didn't break the table?
He's a big lad as well. You know what I mean? He's a big lad.
And the table doesn't break. They don't go through the table but twice.
They make good tables in WCW, apparently.
Yeah. And at the very end of the match, I believe it's Bobby the Brain Heenan says that was a mess, which is quite apt. It was entertaining, but a bit of a mess.
Yeah, which is fine. That's what wrestling can be sometimes. Who won that match?
That match was won by Public Enemy.
Yeah. Faces going over.
Yeah.
People were happy about that. And I enjoyed that match. I like a good fight. I like watching fighting.
Like a good scrap, yeah.
Yeah, mate.
Yeah, I enjoy it as well. You don't see many of them like that these days.
No, because they all have to be so professional.
Yeah, you wouldn't see a dog collar. By the way, just to give you a back bit of information on a four-way dog collar match.
Oh, yeah, we didn't explain that. Go on.
So if you're unfamiliar, a dog collar match is where you are attached by a dog collar around your neck and a chain to your opponent. So in this, you had one man from each team was attached to the other one via a chain that is then around their neck with a dog collar on.
Did they ever do that? In WWE, like they did do some of those old gimmick matches once in a while, but I don't think I ever saw in modern WWE. I'm sure they did back in the day, but
I don't recall any. No,
yeah, I like that. I actually think it's a good dynamic in those.
It's interesting
because you can't escape
your opponent.
Is the idea, which is like similar to a strap match, but like because you're in a dog collar, it looks more violent.
Yeah, you would never see it these days though, because the implications or the implying of choking. Is just obviously through the entire match and
you always see
don't
that
allow that these days.
You always see the classic spot in those kind of matches where one man's on the inside the ring, one man's hung by his neck outside the ring.
Yeah, classic. Like the chains over the rope, the guys you know,
and you're literally hanging a man.
yeah, and you're literally hanging a man, and the other guy's hanging by his neck with his from this dog collar chain.
Well, last time they did something like that was probably in the Attitude Era. It wasn't part of a match, but do you remember when they hung Big Boss Man?
Yes, that was a bit much, wasn't it? That was like when the times, you know, not to get off topic, but that's like when the times when stuff perhaps went a little bit too far.
Yeah, that was definitely Attitude Era.
Yeah,
proper.
Next up on the card, after that was a mess. Street fight was a cruiserweight title match against Disco Inferno. And Dean Malenko.
Disco Fever.
Disco Ferno's got to be one of the most ridiculous...
Disco Fever. Yeah. That was his music.
It's got to be one of the most ridiculous gimmicks in the history of wrestling. He's basically someone from Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, but I'm sure he was given that because he looks like Tony Manero from Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, that's probably... That would have been where he came up with the gimmick.
Yeah.
From. He has Shake Your Booty written on the back of his ring tights, which is pretty funny. And just the whole thing's quite preposterous. And one thing that really made me laugh is, like, because it was this cruiserweight title match, is sort of, he's trying to be serious and not be disco and not be dancing. And Disco Inferno was always known for, before he did a pin, he'd do a little shimmy and puff up his hair and then go for the pin. And they kept showing this thing where he'd like go to puff up his hair and he'd be like, oh, I'm not supposed to be doing that. And I'm all serious, and he'd cover him, and he wouldn't.
Because Dean Malenko is Mr. Serious, Mr. You know, Man of a Thousand Holes.
And there's a couple of times where, you know, Disco Inferno supposedly forgot he's not supposed to be puffing up his hair and dancing. That was what cost him the pin and stuff like that. And it's really funny. I thought that was really funny.
But relatively methodical and slow for a cruiserweight match. Like, when you say cruiserweight match, that's not necessarily the kind of match that you would think of, though.
No, not these days. These days you associate cruiserweight matches with high flying and big, you know, rope spots and stuff. Whereas I think back in the 90s, cruiserweight matches were often, it was all about their weight. So it's the lighter guys, and, you know, they're often a lot more technical matches than we're used to seeing now in cruiserweight matches.
I mean, you do still have a bit of that these days. Like, people like Drew Gulak are basically very much inspired by the likes of Dean Malenko. You can see it, but I don't know. It was just a lot more methodical than you see with a lot of cruiserweight matches. Just a lot more methodical.
Yeah, it was. There was also like Bobby the Brain Heenan comes out with some ridiculous.
Who does love the brain though?
Commentary points. So in this, he says about Disco Inferno, he says, and this just doesn't make any sense, he's going to be hearing the music a lot louder tomorrow because both of his ears will be on one side of his head. I don't really I don't really understand how that works.
Read us that one more time, mate.
He's going to be hearing the music a lot louder tomorrow because both of his ears are going to be on one side of his head.
That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense. But it's just ridiculous, preposterous things that you hear in wrestling at the best of times. Never mind something that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever, like having both of your ears on one side of your head.
How does that make things
makes your
louder?
Hearing better. God knows. But yeah.
Oh, the brain.
Yeah. Crazy.
Not a scientist, though. Yeah. The brain, but not a biologist by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, it's Bobby the Ears Heenan. so that was a pretty good, you know, standard technical match. Dean Malenko's obviously a technician at the time, known as the Man of a Thousand
Holds. He got the W with his Texas Cloverleaf, didn't he?
Yeah.
So, I always did like a Texas Cloverleaf.
Yeah, Dean Malenko wins by the Texas Cloverleaf submission, which is one of my favorite ever submissions.
Well, you said this the other show, didn't you? That's because you convinced your mate playing SmackDown Taste the Pain that you were
putting a sharpshooter on
when it wasn't.
No, it was a Texas
because club, doing a sharpshooter was too hard a sequence to learn.
Yeah, it was.
Bullshit.
Then we have what I consider to be the only real throwaway match so far on the show, which was Joe Gomez against Steve Mongo McMichaels.
I'll be honest. And obviously, I never watched this match when it first happened. Well, obviously, but I didn't watch this match when it first happened because I didn't have access to WCW at the time, and I was only 11.
Yeah.
But I pride myself. I know quite a lot about wrestling. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing a bloody podcast.
Yeah.
I had not a bloody clue who either of these people were.
Would you like to know some information?
Well, I knew that. I didn't know anything about Joe Gomez. Steve McMichael was an NFL player, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Married to Deborah Marshall, who then used to be married to Deborah Marshall, who obviously become on to be Deborah, famous in the WWE.
Well, Deborah McMichael, she was known as first in the WWF, wasn't she?
Joe Gomez there's not much backstory to him. He was sort of in and out of WCW for a long time. He's still semi-active on the independents, and he wrestled for NWA Florida. And he trains people and stuff now. Well, but very sort of normal end to a life, not end to a life, but normal continuation of a professional life after wrestling for wrestlers. Wrestlers usually go on to do either really, really good stuff famously or really, really bad things. Like, they either continue on and they're like a legend of the industry and they train all the young up-and-comers, or they go completely off the wall crazy.
Have a fall from grace.
Fall from grace, you know, end up a crackhead and, you know, eventually find God or something.
Yeah.
But this is kind of normal. He's just sort of in and out of wrestling still, does some training on the side and
cracks on.
Quite a throwaway match. Interesting, Steve McMichael.
That was his singles debut, I believe.
Yeah, really?
Steve Mongo, Michael, he'd had tag matches and stuff prior to that. First time you saw him on camera, I did a bit of research as well. First time you ever saw him on camera was actually on WWF television. I think it was WrestleMania X, so WrestleMania 10, which was headlined by Lawrence Taylor versus Bam Bam Bigelow.
Which one was it, X or 10?
Well, X is 10, isn't it, dickhead?
Ah, trolling. Trolling and patrolling.
Not bad. WrestleMania 10, X in Roman numerals.
Okay.
Lawrence Taylor, which is headlined by Lawrence Taylor versus Bam Bam Bigelow. Apparently, he was a teammate of Lawrence Taylor's, I believe. Yeah. Hopefully, I'm not getting this wrong. And that's when you first saw him. So that was 1995. And then obviously, he's gone into training after that. And like, it wasn't too bad for a singles debut match, I didn't think. What are you smiling at?
I'm listening.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm listening. And it's interesting. There's very small little tidbits of information you can get, backstories of these wrestlers. From the match itself, what I did find interesting was the finish. Steve Mongo and Michaels got the win with a tombstone pile driver finish, which is something, had he been for another large wrestling promotion at the time, he would not have got away with using.
No.
And it's interesting to see that being used, such a big famous move, obviously, of The Undertaker's and Kane's.
Well, everybody calls it a tombstone piledriver. They don't even try to rename it. That's just what it's known as in the industry.
Yeah. And then he just uses this as just like, that's going to be my finish. Interesting. So that was probably the only throwaway match. The next segment was a promo, which is interesting and I think brings up the first real interesting out of wrestling story arc that's on this show.
Right, go on.
So it's a Ric Flair promo. He was talking about he's obviously part of the Four Horsemen. Mm-hmm. He's with Miss Elizabeth, mm-hmm. okay, and he's with Nancy Benoit, okay,
Woman.
Who is called Woman on this, which is.
She was in ECW.
Woman. Who came up with that name? What should we call this female wrestler that we have, or female valet? Let's just call her Woman. So,
I mean, that's what she was called when she was with Sandman in ECW.
Yeah, I know. I'm not disputing that. What I'm commenting on is the hilarity in calling a woman who is wrestling, or not wrestling, sorry, working for your wrestling promotion, just Woman.
Yeah, it was funny, and she was cracking onto me and Gene, wasn't she? Like, they were talking about having a private party with me and Gene.
Yeah,
which was really funny, to be perfectly honest.
It was. So,
what did they say now? There was a quote there. I bossed it, but basically, it was funny as well.
As they're going out of the promo, Mean Gene says, "We're fixing to have a pole vaulting competition here." Which really cracked me up.
That's some kind of knob gag.
Yeah. So Ric Flair and Mean Gene are the two males in here. Mean Gene being obviously the given the interview, and Ric Flair's there. They've got two women there, and Mean Gene, as they're coming off camera, says, "We're fixing to have a pole vaulting competition here."
As in, we're going to be knobbing these ladies.
They're going to be using our penises to pull them. So hilarious.
Tell
stuff
though,
for the time,
how
really.
Would that work mechanically though?
I have no idea. Right. Anyway.
So that promo runs directly into the match that it was promoing, if that's a word. Flair, obviously, the man, versus K-Dog, Conan O'Dolay, for the United States Championship or title. US title, obviously. They didn't say championship then, did they?
No, it was always titles was then, title. Weren't they? They weren't championships. This is Conan pre-gangster gimmick that he
obviously there was no LWO or anything yet then, and like he was kind of a tough nut looking guy, but he was a bit of a blue chipper really, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He was sort of a out and out wrestler, sort of feisty, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was already a star in Mexico, like, though, wasn't he? Mm. And this was obviously, I'm sure this is them beginning to showcase him a lot more in WCW. And he was a title holder, was he not?
The title holder, yes, he was.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was an interesting match. Stan, I've heard a lot of criticism recently online about Ric Flair's matches and how Ric Flair essentially only ever had one match, but he had it with everyone.
He would feed the baby face,
yeah,
get beat down, be cowardly,
yeah,
come back through nefarious means,
yeah,
and then either win or lose. If he won, he would screw somebody somehow.
Yeah, and this is
that was his. Oh, yeah, that was a Ric Flair match. Yeah,
yeah,
and more often than not, he would get color. He didn't in this match, but quite often he would bleed.
Yeah, he didn't in this match, but he would often bleed.
He loved the bit. He loved bleeding. I reckon he had a blood fetish.
Yeah,
has a blood fetish.
Ric Flair loved to blade and bleed all over the show.
Yeah.
It's an okay match, as we say, standard Ric Flair match. Lots of like cowardly heel work, putting Miss Elizabeth in front of him when Conan's about to jump off the turnbuckle.
There was a lot of schmoz with the ladies.
Yeah.
Basically, weren't there?
Yeah, woman. Or Nancy Benoit takes off her shoe at one point.
And, not just any shoe, it was a stiletto.
It was a high heel.
Yeah.
And being the heel, she used her heel to smack Conan with.
See what you did there.
And then Ric Flair, so after that screw finish, does the most ridiculous rope-assisted pin.
Yeah.
So a rope-assisted pin in wrestling, if you don't know, is where they pin and illegally, to get extra leverage, put their...
Extra leverage? What a load of bollocks, anyway! Not more leverage, it's just holding them down.
Yeah, to get extra leverage, they put their feet on the bottom rope or the second rope. Ric Flair here...
Top rope, wasn't it?
Ric Flair here puts his feet on the top rope, so he's almost doing a handstand whilst pinning him. And another recurring theme in this show is that the referees are dumb. Okay,
yeah.
The ref somehow doesn't see that Ric Flair is practically doing a handstand with his feet illegally on the top rope,
yeah,
to get this extra leverage for the pin. And that is just hilarious.
Yeah.
Referees dumb as shit. Okay,
yeah.
And oblivious to anything that's going on.
So something I noticed in this match, and it's something you see all the time actually in wrestling, even to this day. You know when somebody's got a submission hold on? Right, and they're writhing in pain, and they're going, ah, it hurts. I don't know how much longer I can hold this. And they're flailing around.
Yeah.
Right? They flail, don't they, when people are in submissions,
yeah,
and they're in pain.
Yeah.
Quite often, and Conan did it in this match, they tap the fucking mat.
Oh, yeah. People always...
You've tapped out! That's the match over!
It is.
Really annoys me, that. Really annoys me.
People used to always do it. Flair used to do it when people put...
He only did it twice, Conan. He didn't do it three times. I don't know what the rule is in the UFC or whatever, but usually it's three quick taps.
Yeah, Flair did it a lot when people put him in his own submission. When people put Flair in the figure four, he would always slam his fists over and over again on the match.
You've just tapped out, match over.
And I used to go, when I was a kid and still believed in, you know, this is all real, I used to get so mad and go like, why isn't the ref, he's tapping out, why isn't the ref saying anything? But yeah,
that is the presentation. You can't do that, that's the match over.
Yeah, well, it's wrestling.
Don't do it, wrestlers.
Professional wrestling, innit? Don't do it, wrestlers, in 1996.
They still do it to this day. Wrestlers still do that to this day.
Yeah, it does kind of take you out a little bit.
Yeah, it annoys me.
Yeah.
Really annoys me. But anyway, obviously, Flair got the win via nefarious means.
Yeah. We then have more of the main storyline.
Yeah,
teasers.
The Outsiders, third man storyline.
Mean Gene's outside of the Outsiders locker room. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that the voice that he hears inside the locker room sounds familiar. Somewhere in the back of his brain, it's registering that he's heard it somewhere before. And then
Hulk Hogan's voice could be anybody else's.
Yeah, like
voice.
Hulk Hogan could sound like anyone but Hulk Hogan. And spoilers, by the way, for the end of the show. And they then continue to tease Eric Bischoff. Where is he? Where the hell's Eric Bischoff? No one's seen him for ages. No one's heard from him. Where's he gone? He got attacked by the Outsiders. That red herring being laid further down.
Yeah.
And then after that, so we have the continuation of what I was saying before about the storyline that's relevant, the other storyline that's relevant to news this day, a real life story arc, should I say, because the match is Arn Anderson and Benoit, part of the Four Horsemen, against Kevin Sullivan and the Giant, or Big Show.
The Dungeon of Doom.
Benoit, at this point, has Woman, who would become Nancy Benoit, as his in storyline is his valet, and she's his manager. She's left Kevin Sullivan.
Oh, of course.
She's left Kevin Sullivan in storyline for Benoit. And at this point, Kevin Sullivan and Nancy, a woman, were in real life...
Married.
Married.
Yeah, so they were.
And this storyline happened. What happens eventually, or what happens is, Kevin Sullivan apparently insists that Benoit and Nancy, they travel together, they're always seen together, they eat together, keep the kayfabe up, keep people believing.
Kevin and Nancy, that they're still married.
Yeah.
To the rest of the boys, basically.
Yeah. No, not the boys. To the boys know that they're not really married. But keep
to the to outside eyes.
Keep the outside eyes on that Benoit and Nancy are actually together, because that's the storyline, that's what we're going with. Nancy ends up leaving Kevin Sullivan for Benoit.
Yes.
In real life.
Yeah.
IRL, to the newbies out there.
IRL?
It's an abbreviation of in real life.
Is it really? Texas, I've never heard that one in my life, kid.
Okay, so in real life, then Nancy ends up leaving Kevin Sullivan for Benoit, and then obviously we all know what happens with Benoit and Nancy Benoit.
Ultimately, yes.
Ultimately, if you don't know, it's probably...
You do know.
You do know, but just for those of you who somehow don't know, it's probably one of the biggest incidents to ever happen in wrestling history, is in the real world, Nancy Benoit go on to then have a child together. And tragically, one day, Benoit murders her...
His family.
...and his son, and then commits suicide. Mm. Almost brought the entire industry down. But I thought it was interesting that this pay-per-view had that dynamic on it where, you know, this is before she's left Kevin Sullivan, but the story is involved in the storyline.
Right, okay, so they were still married at the time of that.
At this time, Kevin Sullivan and Nancy Benoit are still together in real life. Storyline, Benoit and Nancy are together. And then in real life, what would happen is she would leave Kevin Sullivan for Benoit. So I just found that part fascinating, that this is around that time that those sort of things that was going on.
Crazy. Like the match itself?
I thought Kevin Sullivan looked really bad.
Right.
He was blown up. He was not in the best shape you've ever seen him in. And he was, particularly towards the end of the match, he was like barely lifting people off for suplexes. He was a couple of botched spots. He just looked completely knackered. He just didn't look in good ring
physically,
shape.
Physically, like, not in ring shape, no. I mean, he looks muscular and impressive for an older man, like.
Yeah, for an older man, he looks still sort of that sort of...
Jacked. Basically jacked to the fucking gills, basically.
Like, he's still got that kind of flabby flare muscle going on a little bit.
Yeah, but he was big, big, thick, muscular, strong man.
Yeah.
But not as strong as the giant man who won the match with a choke slam.
Giant or Big Show. This is really early on in Big Show's career. Big Show with a raspy voice, or gravelly voice. Big Show and Kevin Sullivan get the win. Mm-hmm. And after that, there's a bit of a schmarz with Benoit attacking Kevin Sullivan on the on the outside, sorry.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it continues, and then there's a bit of another run-in from the giant woman, as she's known in this. She shows up, and it's a bit of a all over the place finish.
It's showing, I believe it's starting to show dissension within the ranks, basically, isn't it? It's starting to show respective groups beginning to possibly fall apart.
Yeah, this case being the Four Horsemen.
Yeah.
It's starting to show those like things that
cracks are starting to show.
The cracks are starting to show.
Any more to say about that, mate?
No, that was probably, other than the Steve Mongo McMichaels Joe Gomez match, I think this is the other one that I didn't really take much away from. It didn't really stand out to me too much. I wasn't too interested.
I'm not gonna disagree with that.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna disagree with that.
Moving on.
The main event of the evening.
Before we get there, though, we've got the most 90s promo package ever. Scott Hall and Kevin Nash hinting at the Bischoff mystery a little bit more. Hinting that he's the third man, and it's just, I thought it was really fun to see this like really over the top cheesy 90s promo package where there's like frames swooping in and out and like newspaper headlines.
You had a lot of that in this pay-per-view. The really bad picture in picture.
Yeah.
Where it only took up a little tiny portion of the thing, and you couldn't even see the match properly. That annoyed me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Where they'd split the screens.
Yeah, but they didn't just split the screens in half.
They'd put a huge...
They put a telly within your telly screen, so, two small ones.
Yeah.
So you've got two small boxes within your own
So to give you
framing.
A representation, they split screen it, but they split screen it, make the screens really small with this huge graphic behind it, so it's quite
like
difficult.
Bash at the beach and the waves and all that kind of stuff and surfboards.
Yeah, so you're essentially watching two camera angles at the same time of different things. And
but it's... small on your screen. It's like when you watch Botchamania on YouTube and they fuck with it so that they don't get taken down. It's that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks that way. It's quite difficult to watch and interesting for the night. It's just an interesting, like, 90s TV production, man. It was all about the graphics.
Yeah, bad graphics.
And then we have Michael Buffer.
Yeah, man, he must have cost a pretty penny.
So, I have some research for this.
Go on.
Michael Buffer, famous for Let's Get Ready to Rumble! That Michael Buffer.
Yeah, sorry.
He's accumulated. He's famous for boxing.
Let's Get Ready to Rumble.
Announcing. He has accumulated a total wealth for announcing across his career of $400 million.
Let's get ready to rumble. Five words.
Okay. He's accumulated from ring announcing and saying, let's get ready to rumble, just $400 million.
For saying five famous words and having a cool sounding voice.
Yeah. To give you some insight into how much money WCW had at the time, WCW reportedly paid him $150,000 for each WCW appearance that
not
he made.
Not bad. For that 10 minutes work.
For 10 minutes work a night, that's not too shabby of a paycheck, is
but
it?
But his brother actually did better than... I mean, I don't know if he's done better with him money-wise, but... So let's get ready to rumble. Michael Buffer's famous for those five words. His brother Bruce Buffer, who obviously commentates for the UFC, announces for the UFC, did better because he's just famous for two words. All he says is, it's time.
Wow, what a family. Seven words between them.
Millionaires.
And at least $400 million. Christ.
Can't be bad. But they've got cool sounding voices, so.
Well, you know, I know two other people with cool sounding voices. Hey. So this is the main event. The Outsiders, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall versus... And a mystery man.
And a mystery man.
Versus Sting, Macho Man, the Randy Savage... And Lex Luger.
That's your man, the Randy Savage. He's got like a caveman gimmick.
Yeah.
Where he just hits women on the head with a club and drags them back to his cave.
Walking around with
the Randy Savage.
Long cloth and a boner.
Yeah. Yeah. Just taking women.
No, so Sting, Macho Man, and Lex Luger are the good guys in this, the baby faces.
Mm-hmm.
And they're luminous in their appearance. All their gear is incredibly brightly coloured.
And they've all got Sting face paint on, basically.
They've all got
they?
Sting face paint on. This is pre-Sting turning all dark and into the Crow. This
But he wasn't bleach blonde Sting, was he?
No, he wasn't bleach blonde, but he's still sort of surfer Sting.
But he didn't have his bleach blonde flat top, though. He was famous for in the early 90s.
No, he didn't. This was a pretty good match. This is obviously the most famous match on this whole card.
But obviously... Just the two outsiders, the third man conspicuous by his absence.
Conspicuous by his absence.
Or her absence. We don't know. Mystery person.
Mystery person or her absence, indeed. Who could it be?
Yeah, who?
And then, halfway through the match, so Sting does a stinger splash onto Kevin Nash. The stinger splash is probably, in my opinion, one of the most underrated moves in his arsenal. Stinger splashes looked amazing. Yeah, stinger splashes.
Just to jump onto somebody in the corner.
Yeah, but it's the way he did it. He'd almost come over the top rope. I'm a big Sting mark,
by
the way. But yeah, and it always looked amazing. Inadvertently hits Lex Luger. Lex Luger falls to the outside, unable to continue.
Yes, no, this is true. Sorry, I will divulge on that, but something earlier, Razor does a little promo before the match. He says a few words. And did you notice that he calls Mean Gene Scheme Gene?
Yes, I did notice that.
Which is obviously, that was part of the WWF New Generation promo, wasn't it? With Billionaire Ted and the War Room and all that kind of stuff. And they called him Scheme Gene. The fact that they're starting to blur the lines between two companies programming is good and clever.
This is like
it's the start of that meta shit happening, though, isn't it? It's the real genesis of that stuff happening.
Yeah, WCW really became famous from around this time, 96, 97, 98, of really blurring the lines between reality and storyline. And this is like tiny little nuances of that, of Scott Hall, you know, referring to something from WWF in just one word, scheme,
yeah,
essentially. And it's really, it's sort of, on a retrospective point of view, interesting to see that that's where the genesis of all this happening,
yeah,
is starting to take place. Mm-hmm. So at this point in the match, Sting has done the Stinger Splash onto Kevin Nash, inadvertently hits Lex Luger, who falls to the outside.
Of a pansy-ass injury.
It is. He's unable to continue. He's lying down. My next note is, how many WCW officials does it take to carry a stretcher? Because they put
Is that a joke?
Yeah, it's not legitimate. I didn't count them. There was millions of them.
I was waiting for a punchline, mate. Sorry.
No, that was my thing. I was just like, they put him on a stretcher. There's about 50 WCW officials come down to wheel him out on this stretcher, and it just makes for a funny visual.
Yeah.
It's like, how can I help? I'm going to put my little finger on the corner of his stretcher as he's getting wheeled out.
I'm doing my part.
Yeah.
But there's the match itself. What did you think of the match itself? The nuts and bolts, the wrestling that happened.
It was very story driven, which I thought was really good. Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, the outsiders, they were being really heelish, doing heelish stuff you don't really see anymore. Stuff such as getting someone in a hold, and then when the referee's not looking, you grab your partner's hand to put more leverage and more pull on the hold.
Yeah.
Doing stuff while the referee can't see, quotation marks, because the referees, as we found out from earlier on with Ric Flair's pin, are dumb as shit
in WCW,
and they can't see something that's happening right in front of them.
Yeah.
And it was just like old school heel work, grabbing hand, pulling leverages. Baby faces are really sort of fighting from underneath, fighting back up, and the crowd's very much on the side of the baby faces for this one.
Did you see Nash drop an elbow clean onto Macho's head when Macho sat up?
Yeah, that was a botch spot.
I mean, not to be a cock and just bring attention to botch spots, but like that looked like it.
Yeah, so Kevin Nash goes to drop.
Who's a very, very, very large man.
Yeah, he's over 7 feet tall.
And he's jacked to the gills.
Yeah, very young and big, muscular man here. Goes to drop an elbow on Macho Man. Macho Man sits up. For some reason sits up. I'm assuming he was supposed to...
He did two. He did one elbow drop and then did... That was the second elbow drop.
Yeah, I'm assuming he was supposed to get out of the way, but he sits up and they mistime it, and Kevin Nash lands right on the top of his head.
Like in his head and neck.
Yeah, it did not look like...
Didn't look fun, did it?
It didn't look good, and it didn't look like it was...
It just looked like it hurt.
Very nice to feel, yeah. It looked painful. Yeah, so old school, and then it's sort of beaten down, and you've got the Sting's hurt on the outside. Macho Man's in the ring, really like sort of writhing in pain. And then, oh shit, here comes Hulk Hogan to save the day.
That's amazing that he's come down, being the good upstanding member of the roster that he is. He's the blue chipper. He's always been there. He fights for the rights of every man. He's a real American.
He is. He's pointing. He's shouting stuff. He's coming to the ring to save the day and get rid of these nasty outsiders. But plot twist, he drops a leg drop on Macho Man in the ring.
Oh my god.
Probably the biggest heel turn in wrestling history.
Probably. Yeah, probably. No. Like, the crowd didn't really know what to do, did they?
No, the crowd was strange. The crowd sort of started cheering when he was coming down. Then he drops the elbow. There's almost disbelief in the crowd, where half of them are still sort of cheering and the other half are booing. It then very, very slowly changes to all boos. And escalates.
There's a smattering, like, there's a bloke in the front row with an ECW shirt on.
Yeah.
And he was fucking loving it. He was popping. He was had his hands in the air. He loved it. But a lot of the, maybe I'm stereotyping here, it's that Southern wrestling fan. Maybe I'm stereotyping all people from the South as thick hillbillies. I don't know. But a lot of them seemed genuinely upset that America's superhero
had turned
into a bad guy.
Yeah. And Tony Schiavone says a great line where he says, "We have seen the end of Hulkamania," which is brilliant because it sort of brings real heat back to Hulk Hogan, because in truth, Hulkamania was a
Been dead a couple of years.
Yeah,
probably,
and been really faded out, and his fans' interest in him had really dwindled at this point. So
it had to be done, otherwise, where would Hook have gone from there?
Yeah, he would have just phased out into nothingness and been forgotten about. But this really brought him round full circle and him turning heel. And I personally, obviously, as we continue this series, we're going to see more of heel Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
But I think that's my favourite Hulk Hogan, is heel Hulk Hogan.
Mm. But obviously, the match was no contest.
Yeah, so the match ends in a no contest.
Like, basically, Hulk puts the pin on Macho. Scott Hall counts three.
Yeah.
But which was quite funny.
Yeah.
To be fair. Brilliant healing.
Yeah, excellent. And it's become one of the most iconic images that you see over and over again in documentaries about wrestling and in promo packages about wrestling and from the 90s. And as moments in the 90s go for WCW, this has got to be up there with one of the biggest moments ever. Is when they
one of the biggest moments in wrestling history, mate.
Yeah, when they turned Hulk Hogan heel, it was just one of the greatest things they ever did, storyline-wise.
Well, he was literally a superhero. He was the first wrestling superhero that the entire world, almost, or the entire of North America, had really got on board with. Wrestling had never been that big in the nation's eye before Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan brought it to the masses and blew it up. And to see a man who is basically Captain America,
yeah,
so to speak, turn and become
turn his back
Thanos
on everyone. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and turn his back on everyone.
Turn his back on everyone.
And he really was
Mr. Eat your vitamins, say your prayers, thank Jesus and everything will be great. And he turns into a bad guy. I loved it. And well, he explains it on the mic, obviously, doesn't he?
Yeah, he explains it all. He goes in a really long, lengthy promo about why he's done what he's done.
How much shit starts filling the ring as well, getting hit with beers and
the fans, as we were saying, they're sort of not sure what to do at first. It sort of gradually turns and goes into a real heat, real like hatred, and they're throwing so much stuff in the ring. Like there's cups of God knows what being thrown in. There's water everywhere. There's like rubbish is filling up the ring, just absolutely everywhere, and it's one of the most interesting storylines ever, as we've said. And also what's interesting is at this point, obviously this is the very beginning of the New World Order, and Hulk Hogan calls it the New World Organization.
He calls it the New World Order of Wrestling, brother, first. That's a soundbite, which everybody knows.
Yeah.
But then, two or three times after that, he calls it the New World Organization, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Which sounds like some kind of marketing firm.
It doesn't. We are the New World Organization. Yeah, so, good show overall. I really enjoyed it. I am a big fan of this era of WCW anyway, but it's been a very long time since I watched this pay-per-view.
He does real healing, though. He really jumps straight into that heel role. Like, all the rubbish he's filling the ring and all this crap represents the fans. It's amazing. And I actually noticed Scott Hall does a little suck it sign to the crowd.
Yeah.
Which,
then
I don't know if they stole, DX stole, who knows? They might have done. 96, it was pre-DX.
Pre-DX, maybe they did. I mean,
and basically we end
across top, and then we end with a
Hulk Hogan, you can go to hell, Shivani basically.
Yeah, Hulk
says.
Hogan, you can go to hell. And then it fades out.
Credits on a wrestling show.
Yeah, interesting. Credit package at the end.
As producers,
I say,
and
yeah, 90s man, all about the graphics.
But very important show, very entertaining. I really enjoyed watching it, and I really look forward to diving back into this area, basically, and just going along the story of the genesis of the NWO.
Going along, following the storylines that are happening, and obviously this is the birth of the NWO, seeing where they went. If you look at things, you've got to try and look at things with not too much retrospect, because at some point I'm sure everybody who wrestled on that show ended up in the NWO in some form or another, because at points it got really crazy. We're going to be doing every Monday Nitro that preceded this show. So we'll be starting with, obviously, the first Monday Nitro back after the heel turn. Then we're going to be going through all the way to Hog Wild, which is the next pay-per-view that they did. And I think it's going to be a great little section of WCW's history here in 1996.
It's literally the birth of the NWO and the start of them winning the ratings war, really, surely.
Yeah, it's the start of when they really started taking over in the ratings. And I'm excited going forward with this little series. I'm sure after we're going to do another series. As for now, though, we can tell you about our social media, which is on Twitter, it's at Can't Heat Pod. On Instagram, it is at Can't Heat Podcast.
Let us know. We want to hear from you. Let us know what we should be focusing on, but we want to hear from you. We love talking to you.
We would love a bit back and forth from you. And we'd love to hear what your thoughts on the show are. If you can, it really helps us out if you recommend us to a friend. And until then, see you in 2 weeks.